Okay, so yesterday I tried to review what I call closed string Romer-Wittmann invariants. The main aspect I tried to emphasize was localization with respect to a torus action. So I have a couple of things to add about that, and then we'll move on to discussing open string Romer-Wittmann invariants, which is really a new, if you want, a new field of research. It's a recent development. It's less understood, the theory, the fundamental theory. It's less understood than the closed string theory we discussed yesterday, but it's very interesting. So what I wanted to add about that, the main example discussed here was this, what's called the resolved conifold was really the total space of O minus 1 plus O minus 1 over P1. And we discussed last time how to classify, we classified fixed loci in NG naught of x, some degree. And then what I ended up with was I picked up some particular fixed locus of this form. You could eventually have more horizontal components like that. And I discussed how you can evaluate the local contribution. So we got a complicated local contribution that looked like, so we have this local contribution, which is essentially, schematically, it's a product of edge factors by edges, the horizontal components. And then we found some integrals over, in this particular case, if this component has genus G, we get an integral over G over the Lyman 4 moduli space with some number of, for some number of horizontal components, which I call the valence of the vertex V. And what we had here was a Hodge class whereas here we get the product of Manifold class. Q1 being this fixed point here. So that was the structure of this particular fixed locus. Now we can have more complicated fixed loci in this geometry. You can add components here. That would only complicate matters. You get more integrals like that. It's a product of the integrals like this. And the idea is that in order to compute an invariant, so here you want to compute an invariant CGD, and the integral over virtual class of 1, you have to sum of all such fixed loci which are compatible with genus constraints, degree constraints, and stability constraints. And that makes this sum finite. You have to sum over finitely many graphs in the end. Well, what I wanted to point out is that for this geometry, there is a very nice closed formula for the Gromov-Witten potential, which was proved by Faber and Pandari-Pandey using a very, very neat trick, which is actually quite powerful, and it's relevant what I have to say next. So there is this Faber-Pandari-Pandey formula. And they show that the Gromov-Witten potential for this x, generating functional of the string coupling GS and Q, has a very nice closed expression of this form. Okay, so there, again, it's very simple expression, and this is supposed to, if you expand this function in powers of GS, you're supposed to generate all the Gromov-Witten invariants for this X. So now you can think for a while, you can pause and think, well, what happens here? We have to do a very complicated computation, which is this sum of all possible graphs. When the genus is high and the degree is high, these are very many, you know, you get many graphs. It's very hard, so it's quite surprising you get such a nice formula. And the trick these guys used was a very nice one. Namely, one observation is that this particular local thing, it's really an equivariant expression. It takes values in the equivariant cohomology of a point. And when you sum over all fixed loci, the weight dependence, or the dependence on the torus weight, goes away, and you're left with some numerical answer. Now, these guys exploited this particular feature by, so they make a nice, you make a nice or a good choice of torus weights. Since the answer is independent of the torus weights, you can in particular make the we can do the computations by choosing a nice set of torus weights. And if you remember in the local description, we had something like this. The torus action was written like this. In terms of local coordinates, well, you can choose, for example, lambda u to be 0, lambda z plus lambda v equals 0. That's a particular nice. It's a good choice, and why is it a good choice? Because with this choice, it turns out that only graphs with precisely one edge contribute. The others are zero. You just have to write down to work out these factors here carefully. And you realize that for that choice of weights, you get this nice feature that only graphs with precisely one edge contribute. The others are trivially zero. So that means you have only to sum over fixed loci that look like this. A genus G component here, a G1, G2 component there, and this is a map B2 1, for precisely one horizontal component. And now this makes the computation much more manageable, and you can prove you have to use two identities. And actually, this is a very nice exercise. If you never did one of these computations and you're interested in learning how to do this, it's a very good exercise. You have to use along the way two identities in the cohomology ring of the Dilly-Mumford space. That's one of them. The other one is that. Integrate you get the Bernoulli numbers. So if you use these two identities, one can prove this closed formula. That's a very good, you know, exercise to go through if you like to understand how this machinery works. Okay, so that's one observation, and that's important. So you can simplify your life a lot by making a clever choice of torus weights. In the open string case, this a nice choice of torus weights would be even more important. Now, the other thing I wanted to say is that this you know, the localization computation applies equally well to other toric geometries. So it's nothing special about this particular geometry. I used it just because it's sort of the simplest possible one. But you can, for example, try something like the total space of O minus 3 over P2. That's another example of local toric threefold. And in that case, you can go through the same set of motions. You have to classify the fixed loci and try to derive the invariants. And again, it's a good exercise. So if you look at what sort of fixed loci you have, you're going to have three invariant hyperplanes in P2 in the zero section, and then you get all sorts of maps of this form. Yeah. And so on. And in this case, the computation becomes much more complicated. it's essentially the same idea. There's nothing qualitatively new here, but it's just more complicated. Many more fixed loci, and you have to sum of all of them. In any case, it's also a very interesting, well, it's not, a, it's a, it's an interest, well, it's a good exercise to compute the first few invariants and see how this works. But in any case, that's, I wanted to point out that for all tori geometries, we can do, we can apply the same machinery and get a sum like that. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to say about closed strings. And I want to move on to open string invariants. Okay. So this is work done by Katz and Liu, Li and Song, Graber, Zaslow, and well, there is also work done by Kaya and all, and all, in the context of Fukaya categories and morphisms between objects in the Fukaya categories. I'm more familiar with the work of this approach. It's more algebraic geometric in nature, so that's what I'm going to follow. So what's the problem here? Well, the problem is that we're trying to set up a different kind of enumerative problem. So we consider now a target space X, and let me, in this case, take from the beginning X to be a Kolobyov threefold. In other words, it's K-trivial, perhaps non-compact. And inside X, I'm going to consider Lagrangian cycle L. So Lagrangian is the middle dimension of Lagrangian cycle. And the problem we're trying to solve now is you look at Riemann surfaces with boundary. Genus Jigerman surface is H boundary component. And we're looking at maps F from such surfaces to X such that F maps the boundary of sigma into L. So one would ideally would like to try to compute virtual numbers of such maps. It's a sort of a, as opposed to closed string problem we encountered earlier. So the name open strings is related to the fact that this the source has boundary. Now, okay, so first of all, we have to fix some topological invariant. So the topological invariants one fixes in this case, one picks up a relative homology class. Sorry, homology class. And moreover, that's a two class, a one class in L, and to each such, and then associated to this, we have the formal symbols Q and Y, physicists think of Q, as I said yesterday, as like e to the minus the area of the map. And why it has a physical interpretation as well, because this Lagrangian cycle in physics is really a deep brain, so it carries a U1 gauge field, A, which is taken to be flat. And Y is just the holonomy of A around the, or if you want F upper star of A around the boundary of sigma. Okay, so given that, what's sort of the plan? What we would like to have? Well, we'd like to first of all have some analogous moduli space. So before we encountered some moduli space of closed string maps, now here we'd want some moduli space of open string maps to XL, topological invariants beta and gamma. So some good moduli space. we should find some sort of compactification. And then, again, in principle, we expect this modularized space to have components of wrong dimension and so on. So we probably will need to have, again, a virtual cycle in order to define your virtual numbers correctly. So that's a virtual cycle of expected dimensions. And in principle, if you want to integrate and arrange the virtual cycle, you need an orientation. So we'd like to find, or that's the ideal plan. We want all these elements, and then hopefully, if the expected dimension in this particular case is zero, then we can define virtual numbers. If I assume what? Understand the question. Of what? If I assume it vanishes.
So there's a problem with the modularized
space. Well, I'm sure there is a problem. I'm not going to construct a modularized space. Well, for what I have to say, I don't have to make this assumption. But, well, okay, but the problem is that invariants I'm going to define, you're going to see, they really depend on they're really equivariant invariants in some sense. So the existence of a torus action would at least, at least define this invariance in some way. You'll see examples, and, well. So, you want that? And then we want to define the invariance like this. It's an M. And of course, may construct again an open string potential. Which is a generating functional. Okay, what is this? Okay. And we like to understand the structure of these generating functionals. So that's sort of that would be the plan. And unfortunately, to the present stage, we don't really know how to carry out all these constructions in detail. There is various examples. I'm going to discuss the approach. Mainly, I'm going to follow the original approach of Katz and Liu. And in some sense, I'm going just to assume that these elements exist and try to. And I need to make more assumptions to assume that the localization theorem of the Graeber-Pondar-Pandy type of result again holds. And making all these assumptions, you can actually, at least in particular examples, define. Give a computational definition for this invariant. And, you can at least check it makes sense. You can check it against all sorts of large n duality predictions and all those physics predictions, and it's consistent. So there is a nice picture behind it. So at least that, although I don't have there is no completely rigorous construction. So, what I want to say is that, first of all, what the main tool? So if you remember for a moment what we did for the closed strings, in that case, we did have a well-defined modulized space. We had a virtual cycle, and everything was rigorously constructed. But if you think how we computed the closed string invariance in the end, you only need, in the end, if you think about it, you just need, essentially, you need a list a fixed loci. And you also need the tangent obstruction complex for a map. So given these two ingredients, you can actually you can really compute the invariance without really knowing too much about the moduli space. So that's sort of the approach I'm going to follow. So I'm going to assume in the following that there is a torus action on X which preserves L. So there is a torus action on X which preserves L. And moreover, that there is some sort of localization theorem. So that we can actually compute this invariance by summing over fixed loci. And we'll see that this is it gives at least sensible numerical answers. That's the main point I want to make. Okay, so, and moreover, one thing we can do actually is to write down the tangent obstruction complex of a map. This is really like analyzing infinitesimal deformation theory of this map. So it will have a form which is quite analogous to the previous one. I'm going to explain in a minute what I mean by this. As before, T1 is essentially the tangent space to the moduli space at the point F. T2 is the obstruction space. And the deformation theory is encoded in this tangent obstruction complex. These are the automorphism deformation of the domain. Have to explain what this means. The fact is that before, in the closed screen case, we just had cohomology of F over star of Tx. In this particular case, we have really a pair. So if we denote by F del, the restriction of F to the boundary, we get a pair, F over star of Tx, F del TL. And this is this forms a special structure shown by Katz and Liu. This is what's called the Riemann-Hilbert bundle. What this means is that this bundle, the real bundle on the boundary, is a totally real subbundle of F upper star Tx restricted to L. And that follows from the Lagrangian condition. So given this is actually the main our main so yeah? Well, as far as I know, Riemann-Hilbert, that's the terminology they used. I adopted their terminology, I don't know. So the fact is that with these boundary conditions, what happens with these boundary conditions, you can define cohomology groups in sort of following the usual formalism. And this is our main computational tool for open string invariants. Now, before I move on, I should make a point about the moduli space, which is important. So remember, in the closed string case, in order to compactify the moduli space, we added, if you want, nodal pre-stable So maps with a pre-stable domain, with nodal domain. Well, subject to some stability conditions. Well, for the open stream case, life is a bit more complicated, because if you try to compactify, I mean, to construct, to think about the compactification of this moduli space, you realize that, well, you can do two sorts of degenerations. You can have essentially what I call open stream degenerations, sorry, closed stream degenerations, which is essentially, well, the same type of degeneration. You allow nodes. So these are closed stream degenerations. So they are expected to give you some compactification divisors, so divisors. But one can have something else. One can have different degenerations. One can have degenerations like this. In which a node occurs on the boundary. So this is a new aspect of the theory, a new phenomenon that wasn't encountered there. And this is a real codimension one phenomenon. So these are open stream degenerations. And they really give you, if you think about it for a while, they really give you, instead of giving you divisors in the first case, they would give you a codimension one boundary. So a real codimension one boundary. So although I at least don't completely understand the structure of this moduli space, the fact that you have this real codimension one degenerations already tells you that the enumerative problem you're trying to set up will be much more complicated, because you're trying to do some intersection theory on the moduli space with boundary. And that's bound to be more complicated. Very likely, well, in the end, you're going to have to impose some sort of boundary conditions. And we'll see how to do that, at least in the case when you have a torus action. OK, so now I'll consider, you know, my favorite example. So take again. So let's take an example. Take again x to be O minus 1 plus O minus 1 over P1. This is a non-compact, of course, variety. I'm going to define a non-compact cycle in here. So remember, we had local coordinates with obvious transition functions. The cycle L will be defined by the following equations. I have z equals 1, z equals z bar, u bar. So that's a non-compact Lagrangian cycle. It turns out L looks like S1 times R2. And if you look at the geometry, this thing has a zero section. We call it C. And if you look at the geometry near the zero section, you have C. L intersects C along a circle S1, and it's fibered in real planes over the circle. So that's how it looks. The essential point is that L divides C in two disks, D and D prime, holomorphic disks with boundary on L. So now let me call. All right. So now let me try to. Okay. So let me pick a class for open string maps of the form D times the class of D. I'm going to take a class gamma. Okay. So and then I want to look at. Let me try. Okay. I want to consider maps sigma gh to x such that if the lowest star of sigma gh is beta, and then if del lowest star of Z sigma, let's see. I'm going to label the boundary components, so boundary components 1 up to H. So F flow star of the ith boundary components is Ni times class of the boundary of D. So that's the enumerative. That's the enumerative problem I'd like to look at. Namely, consider count virtual numbers of maps satisfying these topological conditions. So as I said a couple of times so far, although I don't quite understand the moduli space, the strategy would be simply to, first of all, there is a crucial ingredient, which is there is a torus action on X, which preserves L. And that's given by where the weights are supposed to satisfy a condition like this. So given this condition, it's the equation of that would be preserved. OK, so now the strategy, and this, so because this preserves L, this induces an action on the moduli space. Have an action on the moduli space. So, as I said before, I'm going to just close my eyes. I'm going to assume that I know what I'm doing, although it's not quite true. But and I'll just propose the following computational scheme for computing the invariance. I'm going to first classify the fixed loci. And then sum of all fixed loci. See what you get. This is a bit subtle. And one of the subtleties, it's related to the choice of an orientation on the moduli space. So your invariant in the end might be ambiguous by a sign that has to be chosen. But in any case, we're going to worry about this later. So first of all, let's see how the fixed loci look. So you have, you can show that the fixed loci, so you have this picture with a disk here, Q1. So we have several types of fixed loci. So you have a generic one in which you have the domain surface has a closed string component sigma naught, and then there is a number of disks attached to it. Delta 1 up to delta h. Sigma naught is collapsed to the origin q1. And then the disks are mapped to d. Each disk is mapped to d. And the map here is just z equals, w I to some to ni. So that's how most fixed loci look. There are some special fixed loci here that look like, for example, a nodal disk like this, delta 1, delta 2. And you can also have fixed loci, a single disk mapping this one. But these are just special cases that can be treated very easily. So in principle, we have to sum over all of them. In some sense, you already notice at this point there is a, if you think about what happened with the closed string situation, in some sense, these fixed loci are sort of, if you take the closed string fixed loci and you just chop them off, you just cut them in half, and you keep only part of that. So that's sort of what happens in what this open string setup does. And that's not a coincidence. We'll discuss more about this later. But sort of that's the picture, the intuitive picture we have in mind. So, well, how do you compute invariance? I guess it won't be very surprising that in the end, the invariance would just, would be determined if you compute it in terms of some, again, integrals on the model and the Dirichlet moduli space. So the way you get there is you write, you pick up, for example, let's pick up this map here, which is sort of the generic case. And let's discuss briefly how you can. Let me give it a name. Let me call tau the. I'm going to call tau sheaf of sections of the RH bundle F upper star of TX F del upper star of TL to make life easier. That's going to be. So that's the local, the tangent obstruction complex for a map like that. And then what you want to do in such a situation is, again, you use a normalization sequence. So this map, roughly speaking, has a closed string part, and it has open string components. And then you just break that sequence into pieces using normalization sequence. So okay, so let me call. In order to do that, I have to call that naught is it's a restriction to sigma naught, and fi restriction to ith open string component. So these are the restrictions. And obviously, what's going to happen is that you can write down sigma like this. Okay, these are going to go tau I, the expression of tau to delta I. Okay, so what do I have here? Well, here you just get essentially. And PIs are just the mark points. So all you have to do now is to write down the long exact sequence for this short exact sequence, and that would give you a computational method, a computational tool for the terms in the tangent obstruction complex. Now, it's a restriction to the disk. Tau is. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. That's my mistake. Sorry. Thank you. Tau is already a sheaf on sigma. Well, now, as I said, what I'm planning to do is define as a sum of all fixed loci. Then you have an integral over sum. Now you see the fixed loci is a fundamental class. So in this case, the fixed loci, you can see they're isomorphic to quotients of the Riemann-Hausdorff spaces by discrete groups. So I can really use the ordinary fundamental class, yeah? And so I have to integrate virtual normal bundle, the Euler class of the virtual normal bundle. So that's And then the essential of the assumption I'm going to make, I mean, I'm going to just assume that we can compute the Gromov of the Voychow Longwell bundle the same way we did in the closing case. So we just look at the T action. On the tangent obstruction complex, and you get the composition in a fixed part plus moving part, and we define, if you want, the K class of N psi virtual to be essentially the alternating sum of the moving parts. So we just that's the definition, and then we can evaluate each term using the the first two terms using the normalization sequence over there. Okay. Okay. So you have to use normalization sequence at this point. And then I can write it down. This sum would become something like, maybe I shouldn't try to write it down. Part of it, and then I'll have to add contributions of those things, and those come with the that's the idea. So now you can look. You can see, already you can see, if you think of, you can already see what kind of terms, or sort of what kind of factors you're going to get here. So what's going to be the structure of this expression? This thing here, since sigma log is collapsed to a point, this is just a copy of the tangent space at x, of 2x at q1. Now here, as we saw before, this is isomorphic to H1 sigma naught O sigma naught tensor T Q1 of X. Okay. Now here, these are the sort of, these would be, if you remember the closing computation, here we had the horizontal factors. Here we have also horizontal factors, the disk factors. But except that now you have to compute them in a different way, because now you have to evaluate cohomology groups of these Riemann-Hilbert bundles. It's not, we can do it, there are several ways of doing it. It's not, it's fairly technical, but not, you know, not extremely hard. And you can do it in several ways. Perhaps the easiest way to do it is to identify them with some with an invariant. So you can extract them from the closing computation by looking at the part fixed by an anti-holomorphic involution. That's one way of doing it. There are other ways of doing it. So in any case, that's let me write down the type of things you're going to get. So you're going to get that. Okay, what's it's going to be? So it's going to be something like this. It's a product from my, well, if I did an automorphism group, which gives you one over H factorial product. And then there is a product from I equals 1 to H. Okay, then I had have an automorphism group. Okay, so this is the moving part of the automorphism group. I just erased the picture, unfortunately. So the moving part of the automorphism group of the domain comes only from automorphisms of the disk, which fix the origin. So that's something like fixing the origin. Okay, so that's there. And then the interesting part, it's an integral on this NGH. So the integrand could be, I get a Hodge class from there. A dual tensor T Q1 of X. Then I get a product I equals 1 to H. This is the moving part of the deformation term, which is going to consist only deformation of the nodes. So the deformation of the nodes will give you this comes from. I want a plus. So thank you. Okay. So that's the way we evaluate this expression. So again, analogous to the closed string computation. You can go further and actually make all this expression explicitly in terms of the torus weights. And you end up with some function of the torus weights. Now, the plan was, what was the plan? Was to evaluate all this expression. All these expressions, and then sum of all allowed fixed laws, and declared the sum to be an invariant. However, that was the plan, but it won't work quite on the nose. The reason for that is that what happens here is that we are really doing a computation on some moduli space with boundary. And what we did, we looked at some fixed loss. We looked at all fixed loss that sat somewhere in the interior and summed over them. Now, the fact that what happens in this situation is that the sum that you get is not going to be a rational number the way it was in the closing case. It's really going to be a function of the torus weights. So after you're done, you get really a function of lambda naught, lambda 1, lambda. So that's just a sign. It's a sign of the, it's an effect. It tells you that you did a computation sort of in a very weird situation, and the moduli space had a boundary. So your result is not really a rational number. So then you can ask, how can you make sense of this invariant, which is not a rational number? And the answer is, the answer is that you have to impose some sort of boundary conditions. And the way to impose the boundary conditions, it's of course not a priori clear, but using some input from physics, we can import the following. How should we impose boundary conditions? And there is a very nice answer to this, as in a paper of Sheldon and Melissa. So they looked at the, they proposed that the boundary conditions in this case, so remember the picture is this, have a Lagrangian. So sort of they proposed that the boundary condition in this case is encoded in a choice of the framing of the boundary of D in L. So in other words, you look at the boundary of D as somewhat a knot, if you want, in L, and you choose a framing. You choose a non-vanishing section of the normal bundle. So how, well, explicitly how this is done, so you must, so the answer was that you choose a framing. And the choice of framing, you can write it explicitly like this. In which you parameterize the boundary by z equals e to the I theta, and this describes a normal a non-vanishing section of normal bundle, and a is an integer, which really parameterizes your choice of boundary conditions. And as I said, it's not a priori clear that this is the right thing to do. Perhaps a mathematician would try, without physics input, to try other things, maybe more natural from the point of view of math. But it turns out that this really gives very nice and remarkable results. In what sense? So let's suppose, so those were functions of the torus weights. Yes?
Before we get to something so complicated and subtle as the framing of the boundary of DNL, you might ask about the dependence on how the boundary D is knotted sitting inside of L.
Yeah, but it's an unknot.
What?
In this case, it's just an unknot.
An unknot.
Here it is, I mean, by construction.
But that was a choice. I mean, you could have.
It's a choice. But in all cases, I know how to do anything. I need a torus action. That's going to preserve the. Yeah.
If it's an unknot.
Yeah. We're going to see next time situations in which you get the link. You get the components of the link are unknots, and they are really orbits of some torus action. So it's interesting, but I don't know any. Well, we can talk about more. Talk about it more later. So, what's so special about those boundary conditions? Well, let me try to make sure I don't get the formula wrong here. Well, let's impose, we fix the framing. So now let's ask, the framing, the torus action, to preserve the framing. That immediately tells you, you get the following relations for the torus weights. So the torus weights are not arbitrary now. They are determined in terms of this integer. So now what you do, you take these values, you plug them in there, and you compute. And it's a very nice result that comes out of this. Namely, I can't give you numbers now, but you can certainly find them in the literature. The point is, you get a generating functional that has very, very interesting multi-Kalman formula. So you come out with a functional. So you just, now you plug in expression of C, and you get some integral invariant and Monte Carlo formula. So just to give you an idea, for the disk level, if I look at a disk partition function, Well, it is generating functional. It takes the following form, to sum over degrees, to sum over an integer that counts multi-covers, and we have 1 over m squared, and the q to the md, y to the md, in which these things are integers. That's quite remarkable, because, you know, a priori, we did many steps here were not properly justified along the way. But in the end, you know, the result is quite spectacular. It's just very nice. And then you have similar formulas for heterogeneous invariant. They are slightly more complicated. I mean, it takes more notation to write them down. But you have similar formula for heterogeneous invariants. You still get some integer invariants and nice multi-cover contributions. So that's very similar to the case you are familiar with from standard Gromov-Witten theory, in which you get multi-cover formulas for Gromov-Witten invariants. So this comes out very nicely here. Okay, and well, okay. Last point I'd like to make about this example. So there are a couple of points. I'm going to talk about some of them later. First of all, this formula has an interpretation in the. No, they depend on A, but A is an integer. It's in N. No, Y is the holonomy. It's in N. These are functions of A. It's a bookkeeping device here. Yeah. And it's quite remarkable because for any integer value of A, you get a string of integer invariants. And that happens to all genus, not just for, this is the simplest functional I go down, but it's quite beautiful. So yeah, open string BPS states. Yeah? We don't. Physically, I guess you'd like to think of them as membranes ending on 5 grains. Yeah. But I don't know why they depend on A. Actually, that's a good question. I didn't even think about it that way. But it's worth thinking about it. I don't know the answer. But you should count in some sense membranes ending on 5 grains.
Do you think this is going to be related to transonics?
Yeah, but still. No, that I'm going to discuss that. But the problem is that how do you justify this dependence from the N theory point, from the BPS count point of view? Yeah. Okay, so one point I'd like to make is that here we can also make a nice choice, a special choice of weights, which is that you can choose A equals 0. So in this case, you get a nice closed formula for all this, for the entire generating functional, and you get a formula that something like this. Yeah. So it's very similar to the closed string computation. You get this from Bernoulli numbers. You have to work out your integrals on the moduli space. Again, the what's special about this is that only components or fixed loci with one delta contribute have a single boundary component. So you get nice formula. Okay, so we are going to use this next time in a slightly different context. And then I'm going to make a, going to briefly go over a last point, and I'm going to finish today. So what I want to say is that this computation is not particular to this particular to this toric threefold. You can look at more general situations. So Graeber and Zaslow considered a different problem in which X was a total space of O minus 3 over P2. And let me, I'm not going to just write down formulas, but you do this. You can, you look at a configuration of invariant hyperplanes in P2 on the torus section. And these are, they form a triangle like this. So these are invariant hyperplanes. And then you define a Lagrangian cycle, essentially a Lagrangian cycle that intersects one of these hyperplanes in a longer circle, and it's fibered in complex lines. So the Lagrangian here is going to be of the form S1 times R2 again. And it's going to intersect one of these hyperplanes along a circle, just as before. So you can set up your machinery again. You can set up your machinery again and try to compute. And what's happening is that the fixed loci here, so first of all, you have to, the topological information is a winding, so you're supposed to give winding numbers and you're supposed to give a degree. So it's plus a degree times h. This is the hyperplane class. So now you try to do the same thing. Try to do the same thing. So you look at the fixed loci. The fixed loci now are going to be slightly more complicated. You have components that collapse to points, to the fixed points. Have a number of disk components that will be mapped to the disk here. But you can also have well, other closed ring components. The way we discussed in the previous lecture, that map to the other invariant hyperplanes. So you're supposed to. So now the computation becomes more complicated. But what I'm trying, what I would like to say, I'm not going to go through the details because that's technical. But what happens is that you're gonna, when you evaluate the local contribution of such. So the first observation is that such a fixed locus, an open string fixed locus, corresponds to a closed string fixed locus. I'm going to call it psi naught. So this sits in the moduli space of open string maps. This is going to sit in the moduli space of closed string maps with H marked points. In other words, if I erase the disk components here, I'm left with some fixed locus in the closed string maps with H marked points of degree D. And there is a one-to-one correspondence like this. So what I'm trying to say is that in more general situations, when you set up your computation, you're going to end up summing over fixed loci in some moduli space which is much better understood, which is this moduli space of closed string maps with marked points. And moreover, this has to satisfy a condition that if you call this point P, then okay, the ith evaluation map applied to psi naught has to be P. So all, in other words, all the marked points have to go to P. So you don't really get all the fixed loci here. You get some fixed loci, the fixed loci selected by that condition. And the rest of the computation, it's very similar. You break your computation into open string component and the closed string component. and you try to go through the details again, and I will be happy to discuss this more if anyone is interested in details, but for now, just trying to give you the end result, just together. So what's going to happen, what's going to really happen here, is that you're going to you're going to get a representation of this open string invariant in the following form. You get something I'm going to call disk factors. Disk factors which depend on the lambdas, on the weights. And then it turns out what I'm going to get I need some notation here. let me try to. I'm gonna write it down first, and then I'm gonna explain the formula, and then that's gonna be the last thing. This is a very familiar object. That's why I'm, for people who do Gromov-Witten theories, that's why I'm trying I want to reach this point. So what happens is that this moduli space XD is really isomorphic to the moduli space of maps to P2, in this case, of degree D. And then you have an evaluation map goes from here to P2 to the H. And C here denotes this curve. And then, so then I have an inclusion of IP of P to the H power into P2 to the H. So now if you look at this expression, and nu is the obstruction bundle on the moduli space, which we constructed in the previous lecture. This is the obstruction bundle. So if you look at this expression, you're going to realize what this is. This is really a multivariable J function. These objects are very familiar to people who are very familiar to anyone who studied the proof of Mirow theorems due to Giffenthal and Lian, Liu, and Yao. So in that case, you get what you get is one variable J function. In this case, you get multivariable J functions. And these are really objects that are very well defined and, to some extent understood. So what I'm saying is that I'm using some esoteric machinery to define these invariants, but in the end, you can express them up to all these factors in terms of something of well-defined objects. And now we can play the same game. We have to choose weights. You have to choose special values of weights, which depend on some framing. And then you can show by direct computation that you get integer invariants, Monte Carlo formula, and that's all I wanted to say.
I was wondering, you mentioned this kind of real dimension, one problem, which I guess is one reason why some people are not convinced that these things are actually topological variants.
Yeah, you have to
watch. What's somehow the
story? Yeah. I refer the question to Shelton. I really cannot. I'd like to be able to answer, but I don't think I can give them.
Well, it's a manifold of corners. So, there are many ways. So, in synthetic geometry, the structure, this notion of this correlation structure. And there are many choices to it, and it's just not in control at all how to, it's not even clear that the framing choice is the only possibility, but it's just such an enormous possibility. And have no idea why any of those choices should be included. That's one example.
The problem would be you kind of guess where, what the context is that these kind of open thing variants do make sense. As a variant.
Well, I just prefer to take the most optimistic point of view. They're always there. So that the data and the homology class is not enough, but that may just screw up the components, so it may not be any more serious about it. The dimensions might jump, but these might still be okay.
You're getting your
spaces can still exist, and each component has to be.
Okay. Okay.